Great. Let's take a look at some more of these things. I want to do this a little bit more quickly so we can get at some topics that these folks are addressing. Here's one that I've always found encouraging. Here's a brother who asks one of these others, what do I do if I screw up? So a brother asks one of the fathers, if by chance I oversleep and am late for an hour of prayer, I'm ashamed that others will hear me praying so late, and so I become reluctant to keep the rules of prayer. But what's interesting about an ancient text like that, though, is besides just the topic at hand, what scholars will use is to look at something like that and they'll say to themselves, what we've got here, there's hours of prayer that they're observing, perhaps quite early, out in the desert. Take a look at this one. There's a rule in prayer that he's following. Obviously, because he's embarrassed about oversleeping, he's following it in the community. Down here, this was a surprise to me because generally speaking, when I think of cells in the desert, I don't see windows. And in this text, shut the door and the windows. So I was wondering what kind of a cell that might be. And what we have to do is take a look at some of those original sources to find out. Having said all that, if by chance I oversleep and I'm late for the hour of prayer, now look at this. I'm ashamed. So here you have an Abba who's going to be trying to help somebody who feels ashamed because of something that's happened. He's embarrassed. And what they're really good at, even the gruff ones, what they're really good at is helping human beings deal with that particular movement in restoration and also the feeling, I'm so embarrassed, I don't want to tell anybody what I've done. So this old man says, listen, if ever you oversleep the dawn, rise when you wake, shut the door and the windows. Isn't that sweet? You know, make that space for yourself. Nobody else has to hear you. He tries to help him with this issue of feeling ashamed. He doesn't want to publicly humiliate him, but he wants him to say his prayers. So, shut the door and the windows, say your office, for it's written, day is nine and the night is nine. God is glorified whatever time it is. And you can hear that brother just sighing. Somehow this Abba created space for his shame and came up with a game plan for how to handle that pattern in the future. And if the mistake is made again in the future, he wants to help him navigate that. I'll just read it out loud. This is almost self-evident, maybe common to somebody here. A brother was restless in the community and often moved to anger. So he said, I'll go and live somewhere by myself. And since I shall be able to talk or listen to no one, I shall be tranquil. And my passionate anger will cease. Remember what we said earlier today about the passion? He went out and lived alone in a cave. But one day he filled his jug with water and put it on the ground. It happened suddenly to fall over. Keep an eye on that adverb, suddenly. He filled it again and again it fell. This happened a third time. And in a rage, he snatched up the jug and broke it. And this is a line that will occur often in this literature. Returning to his right mind. It's like they lose their mind, just like you and me. That's what passion does. I'm insane right now. Returning to his right mind, he knew that the demon of anger had locked him. And he said, here I am by myself, and he's beaten me. I'll return to the community. Wherever you live, you need effort and patience and above all God's help. Amen. The problem is, he was thinking to himself, if I can just get away from this community, if I can get away from these people that are driving me crazy, the problem will be resolved. The problem is, he was still with himself. The problem was lodged. The passion was lodged. So, one text that I thought of Because oftentimes in these sayings, there's resonances within the scripture. I sometimes wonder, is God acting providentially here, tipping over that jug? Particularly if suddenly it fell over and he can't keep it upright. But the text that came to mind, I do not know if this was the text he had in mind, is the story of, if you remember, the Ark of the Covenant, Temple of Dagon, and things falling over, the statues falling over, God intervening in that case. Whether that was in the back of his mind, I'm not quite sure.
Well, I was thinking of the, it reminded me of the marvelous time when the vine died, that Jonah was, and he got so angry, he's out by himself, kind of in a hermitage, and he gets so angry over something like that, and yet couldn't see the compassion.
So his environment that he's placed himself in, his environment is bringing to the surface something that needs to be dealt with. He can't get away from it. He thought, if I just by myself, I can. So you might ask yourself, as I'm serving the church, are there things about my environment that I misidentify? And I've perhaps even made plans to deal with the environment, and the Lord said, no, that environment is where I want you to be. And the struggle will be there, but also the healing. That's a hard one, boy. That's why within these monastic communities, the virtue of stability is so important. Where I promised to stay here and not run. And these sayings are against that background. I promise not to run with everything within me. There's a film on the life of Mother Teresa. Perhaps some of you have seen this film. It's directed by Donald Lowry, who is a gifted director. And there's a wonderful sister who's joined the Sisters of Charity. She works for the homes, for the dying, and so on. Tough work. She was an architect, I believe. She's English. She's looking at the camera. She's about 30 to 35. She's very sweet. And she says to the camera, oh, if I could, I would leave tomorrow. Tomorrow. But I can't. And you said she's just taking it a day at a time. She's made a promise. She knows about this monastic virtue of stability. God has given her work to do. But it's the kind of work you can only handle a day at a time. A lot like the pastor, or other, like a big president of an institution, or other things of such nature, like being a human being. There's a top of my list of favorites. A brother asked an old man, how am I to do well? I don't do anything like a monk. I eat, drink, sleep as much as I like. I'm much troubled by vile thoughts. I shift from task to task. My mind wanders everywhere. That's the question. And the Abba, look what he does. It's so, I was looking at this last night, it's so remarkable. He says, stay in yourself and do what you can without trouble of mind. And it's not a heck of a lot, is it? He's good for 5 minutes and he's thinking about some woman down the street that he's seen maybe in an inn that he's lusting after. He likes to sleep, he's doing everything wrong. And the Abba says, just hang in there. And then he says, it's like Abba Antony. Abba Anthony. He comes alongside this man, identifies with him in his struggle, doesn't want to break him, and he says, if you can manage it, even though it's only a little thing you're doing, yet it is even as with Abba Anthony did mighty things in the desert. I trust God that whoever stays in his cell for God's sake and guards his conscience will be found where Antony is. And that young brother must have just been staggered by that. I think he expected to be scolded. Or he expected to be told, no, this life is just not cut out. You're not cut out for this.
Because he's doing everything wrong. Repeatedly. Habitually. And this Abba says, "You, if you could just stay in that cell, your life on Anthony is great." That must have been like wind in his sails to be told that. See, that Abba has something that we'll look at in a little bit. He's got, the Abba who responds, he's got discretion, discernment. He knows what a particular human life needs. This is a little bit like, I don't think that the sister was struggling with the man, this man, but the idea of hanging one's cloak in a particular place for a long time. For 9 years, a brother was assailed by temptations to leave his community. Every day he picked up his cloak to go, the cloak in which he wrapped himself at night. And at dawn he would think, "I have various torments, they are just today for the Lord's sake." And he did this every day for 9 years. And then the Lord took away that particular temptation. One of the things that we insisted upon is the only day that we have is today. So we don't want to extrapolate from today on into the future, ad infinitum, thinking it's always going to be like this, or how can I possibly make it for the next 2 weeks, or the next month, or the next year? And I say, well, you haven't got that. What you've got is today. So here you have a brother, and he gets up in the morning, and he wraps his cloak around himself, and he says, "All right, I'm going to hang here today." And it all adds up. There'll be other sayings like this one. And this is kind of an interesting one. I'm sorry if I'm blocking this. Stay you.
Just stay.
A brother said to Abba, our seniors, "What am I to do, Abba? My thought troubles me, telling me you can't fast, nor work, nor visit the sick, because even these things are selfish." So we've got a motivation problem here. If my motivations are absolutely pure, it's not worthwhile, I'm a terrible monk, I'm not getting anywhere, those kinds of things. So the old man saw that the devil had sown this thought and said, the book tells him to go, eat, drink, sleep. And here's that theme again, only don't leave your cell. Remember that staying in the cell is what keeps a monk on his proper path. He did it for 3 days and then suffered from apathy or acathy. Now here's what that is. This was known in these monastic communities as the noontime devil. The noontime devil. And it's kind of like this. So I wake up early in the morning. The initial glow of the community has worn off. I say my prayers. I start working on some baskets. I'm thinking about dinner. Well, I'm not going to eat a lot. It's hours away. The initial landscape that looks so inviting, breathtaking in its beauty, is now just hot, barren, boring. That's right. And it gets to be around noon, and you realize, I've got another 5 hours to go before I'm going to see anybody. This is boring, boring, boring. And as it is broader than simple boring, it's God's not working here. This is the biggest mistake I ever made. Isn't there any way out? How am I going to hang in here? And this brother's suffering from that. And he's reached the point where he's, in his own perspective, is thinking anything but this. So he heads back. He follows the instructions of this Abba. And then he starts suffering like that from acidity. So he found a few palm leaves and split them. The next day he began to make a plate from them. And he grew hungry, he said to himself, "A few more palm leaves, I'll lay them out before I eat." After he finished, he said, "I'll wait a little bit before I eat." After he finished, he said, "I'll say a few psalms, and then I shall eat with an untroubled mind." And you get all these comments here. See it there? A few. A few.
a little bit. A few songs. See how it all adds up? That's the heart of the spirituality. It's a spirituality for the long haul. Small steps. Consistent steps. You might even ask yourself that question. So you think about heading home and tomorrow, the next day, whatever. What are the small, consistent steps that he might be asking you to do that will, in some cases, turn a life around? Something small. In the evangelical world, we love the big deal. We love the big deal. And for these folks, you've heard this hundreds of times. For these folks, the big deal is the little deal. And that's a broad stream of classical Christian spirituality. The little deal. The willingness to do something small. It's always manageable, but it's small, but you stick with it. A few songs, a few baskets, but you're not going to run. You're not going to leave that place that he's asking you to occupy. And every once in a while, they scream, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be in this place. Anything but this. And we all smile and say, yeah, I know what that feels like. I know what that feels like. That's why I find them so encouraging. Yeah, because I'm sure all of us have been asked to sometimes occupy a space. And we might be in that space right now. And we're thinking, anything but this. Please, anything but this. I'm sick of this. And he hasn't given us permission yet. Or he's just allowed something providentially to occur, and we wish anything but this, and it calls for that kind of trust. On the basis of what's been revealed to them in Christ.
One question.
That's fortitude, isn't it?
Yeah. I'd be fascinated to hear a little bit about the physical surroundings that they were in. What was the cell like? What did these communities look like? What's the space look like?
Okay, that's a good question. I don't have slides for you. Okay. But Brad's book, Brad Nassif's book, there are pictures in there. Let me describe quickly here what it would look like. It might be a space that's been carved out on the side of a hill. There would be an open door, oftentimes leading into that space. The walls would be fairly bare today. There might be some icons, candles, perhaps a lantern for a monk. There might be an indentation where he could put a mat in terms of an indentation in the wall or on the floor, perhaps a pallet, and that's about it. That's about it. And they would sometimes be together in a community. Sometimes they'd be within shouting distance. Sometimes they'd be a little bit farther away than that, quarter mile, half mile from each other. And then some of the abbas, like an Abba Antony, would, well, this is strange. We don't have time to talk about Athanasius' biography, but Abba Antony, for at least 20 to 25 years, took up residency in a tomb. A tomb as a symbol of Christ, conquering evil, corruption turning into incorruption, all kinds of reasons why he was probably there. But it's Spartan. It's based on necessity and need, not beyond that. So a little bit of flavor, but if you get this book, for example, even on the cover, you can see the cover of a church and all these monastic communities. You can see the brick out of which it's made. It's a learning space. Yeah. The author of this text is Bradley Nassif, Nassif. Answer some of the questions we've been working on today. Why do these folks live in these remote desert monasteries? How does the wisdom speak to us? But I like Like about it, for example, I know this is unreasonable, but you can see a Coptic monk on the back of the boat looking out on that terrain. I don't know how they do that, because they wear these black hats and these black robes. You think you just bank. Yeah.
Help me understand, because I'm looking at a monastic community. I think a building, a monastery, and so we have these people spread out. Are those people also gathering at times for Eucharist? For
yeah, that's right. Generally speaking, on Saturdays and Sundays, they would gather communally.
Even these guys in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because of some of the abuses that crept in. There were some people who were suffering psychiatrically. It was too great a stress. They're asking too much of themselves. That's why these saints are so helpful, and I think why they come into the tradition, they were asking too much of themselves. And these abbots who were very experienced could spot it. And that's why you'll get a long, long list regarding patience and fortitude. They don't want us to break, and they would say Christ doesn't want us to break. So that's where the skill involved in forming that regimen comes to the surface. As you think about it, you don't want to ask yourself, if you've never run a marathon, you don't want to ask yourself, wake up one morning and think you can run 10 miles. You'll just cramp up, and you won't want to run anymore. But what you might want to do is you get up and say, someday I want to run 26 miles, so I'm going to get up this morning and run 100 yards. And my heartbeat will be way up there, my lungs will burn. And the next day you add what? Another 100 yards. You've got a mile or so. All right, now we're going to move into a different side of monastic spirituality. They were very reluctant to judge other people. So let me explain what they would think of as the wrong kind of judging. First of all, they're not talking about making moral judgments. They knew the difference between right and wrong, and what it looked like in a human life. They were experts. They made moral judgments. In fact, we'll have stories here about them making judgments communally. But what they refused was to pronounce God's condemnation upon someone as though they were God. And they would say at that point, no. And the reason behind that refusal was multifold. One of them being, you don't know someone's story like God does. That was very important for them. You don't know somebody's story. So don't presume to know it to the degree that you can step into God's shoes and condemn that person. That's for God. And then they have to deal with all this human fallibility and sin. They'd have to navigate those waters. Remember Abba Moses? Mm-hmm. He not only murdered people, he mutilated people. He was known in his pre-Christian days for how well he used a knife. And so this story appears in this form. It appears in the story where it's the same Abba, and he's got a cask of water on his back, and he pulls out a knife. Probably frightens the brothers around him and pokes holes in the cask, and either sand flows out or water flows out. So there's a brother in the community who's done something. And he's been found guilty. Probably genuine moral transgression. And the other brothers want him disciplined. They want judgment to come. And Abba Moses knows he's going to have to deal with it in some way. He can't just ignore it. But there's something in the response of these brothers to him that's, it's like it sets off a warning light in him. He doesn't like what he's hearing from them in terms of their response towards his brother. So they assembled the elders and sent a message to Abba Moses telling him to come. Then the presbyter went saying, come for a meeting, and Moses is waiting for you. So Moses gets up and he goes. He carries with him an old basket which he's filled with sand and carried on his back. Now the brothers know that when Abba starts to act parabolically like that, there's a lesson to be learned and also a discipline to be experienced. someone's going to get a beating. So, the people who went to meet him said, "What is this, Father?" They're referring to how he's behaving. And so Abba Moses says, "My sins are chasing me, and I don't see them. Have I come today to judge the sins of someone else?" They listened to him and said nothing to the erring brother, but pardoned him. Some of the stories end like that. There's a real funny story where an Abba purposely, there's a better brother, and he's been sinning sexually. He has a woman that he's been letting into his cell and so on, and he's going to be disciplined. And the whole community is up in an uproar about it. And the brother's trying to hide out and avoid discipline. So he's hidden the woman in the cell, in his cell. And the Abba knows it. And so the Abba comes in, and a whole discussion takes place along these lines. And the Abba purposely sits on the lid of the barrel, protecting the woman and the brother. Isn't that? And deals with the sin. It's a little bit like Johnny, which would be in the back of their mind. They want to replicate the pattern that Jesus had of being able to deal with people's sin so wisely and effectively, but not self-righteously and in a condemnatory sense that would drive people away or never fix it. And so it was like they had an antenna, spiritual antenna, and they would pick up self-righteousness very quickly. Or that kind of, "You are the one. You are the one. You should be judged. You are the one." And what he's trying to say is, "I'm the one. I need to deal with this person's sin, but I'm the one." And I think that's one of the reasons, for example, why some of these Abbas, people just would flock to them. And others, they would like to play because they would violate the same principle.
So they didn't say, "Carry on."
Oh, no. No. They would be aware of the situation, but they wouldn't want to deal with the situation as though it's you, not me. Rather, we've got a problem we're going to have to deal with. Yeah. And the wiser ones have that kind of discerning skill. Yeah, I'm going to go through these fairly quickly, but you can see the principle. Abba Joseph, again, if you remember him earlier, again, talking to Abba Holman, "Tell me how to become a monk." And the old man replies, "If you want to find the rest of this life and then the next day to return, who am I? Just no one." It's that self-forgetfulness we talked a little bit about earlier, among other things. So they're dealing with issues of temptation and occasions of sin. And they had a specific understanding of an occasion of sin. You know what I mean by an occasion of sin? It's where we're allowing ourselves to be in a place or a context where we know in the past, if I'm in that place or in that context, I'm liable to fall into a habitual pattern I've already been struggling with. So a student heads back to the room by himself at Eastern. He's struggling with porn on the computer. His roommate's not there. That's an occasion of sin. He's by himself. He's apt to turn the computer on and then just feel terrible. So one of the ways that they dealt with occasions for sin and would coach other people is to coach them in the sense of remembering that Christ is with us. Paul does this, does he not? He does it in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. When he's talking to the Corinthians about sexual sin, he says, "Don't you understand that he's joined himself to you? He's in your body, so how can you take your body and join it to somebody else? By doing so, you're joining Christ to them." They understand that principle. So in some ways, even the idea of bringing Christ into, or bringing ourselves into a vessel that's not his, and so that imagery is in the background. Another old man said, "We suffer this through negligence. If we remember that God dwells in us, we shall never bring into ourselves the vessel that's not his. The Lord Christ abides in us and with us and watches our life. And because we bear him with us and contemplate him, we ought not to be negligent." I think that word negligent I'm not sure if it occurs again. Yeah, it's here. Negligence here, what they would call a lack of vigilance. That's a very important word in this literature. Vigilance contra negligence. So we have negligence here, down here. We have not to be negligent, but we have to make ourselves holy as he's holy. If we stand upon a rock, the wicked one will be broken. Don't be afraid. Fear not. He will do nothing against you. And pray with courage this psalm. So they cultivated purposely an awareness that Christ was both in them and with them, and that their life was led before God. So I learned something about this. I had to be baby Christian. And it had to be 69, 70, somewhere around there. And Detroit had just come out. Do you remember that part? I hope you don't remember that film. It was a bad film. It came out of that. And so I was kind of a new Christian, baby, headed off to the theater, shelled out $5, shame, 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 went into the theater, bored after 20 minutes, walked out, and then Christ ministered to me and reminded me of what I had done. I had brought him in to that place. I learned I can't escape from him. He's committed himself to me. And I wept. It was good. I still remember it. And I learned this principle. Have I been able to carry it out perfectly? No, but I still remember it. I still remember what I experienced and the feeling I have grieved somebody who loves me infinitely by bringing him up. Is he present there in terms of omnipresence and so on? Well, sure, he's everywhere. I don't know how God can bear us sometimes. But in particular, regarding him and human life in whom we dwell, I had taken my mind and my body into a given place and grieved him. And he let me experience that a little bit. And then that principle is somewhat behind a lot of this monastic teaching. Projection, I'm speaking here in the psychiatric sense of projection. You know what I'm talking about? Those things that we most dislike about ourselves. Those things we most dislike about ourselves in terms of either habitual patterns of behavior, emotional responses, and so on. Things we don't like, particularly sinful patterns of behavior. Human beings have an exquisite gift for projecting them onto another human being and condemning that fault and sin in that human being. Displaced aggression. Well, sometimes it's displaced aggression. Sometimes it's a projection onto someone else and judging something in that person rather than facing it ourselves. I was with John Stott, and this had to be in the early 80s, and he had invited some pastors to his home, and he was talking about this principle, and he was with, I guess it must have been a well-known pastor, and they were on the tube in London. They're heading down the escalator into the tube in London, the subway, and they were talking, and then there was, like in a lot of European airports and subways and so on, they're selling perfume and lingerie and so on. So there were women dressed in lingerie, selling perfume and so on, and this man saw these models, and he just went off. This is just a sign of what we become. Look at these women. They're selling it. So angry. He was so overcome with anger, he got to the bottom of the tube. John heads for the train. This man heads back up again, thinking John is still with him. He's so upset. Later on, they became friends, and later on, rises to the surface, the poor man was addicted to pornography. And he projected that sin and the anger and all of this stuff onto somebody else and was condemning them in this place. And they know that dynamic. That's why they're so reluctant to judge somebody else. And so they'll talk like this. A brother being tempted by a demon went to an old man and said, "Those two monks over there who live together live wickedly." Apparently these two monks were close friends. And this Amma knows that that's not the case. But the old man knew that a demon was playing with him, and he sent and called them to him. So he calls these two brothers who've been accused of some kind of sexual sin. He calls them over, and at evening he puts out a mat for them, covers them with a single blanket, and then says to this other brother, "They're sons of God and holy persons." But he said to another disciple, "Shut this slandering brother up in the cell by himself. There's some things he needs to learn. He is suffering from the passions of which he accuses them." So this can be helpful to us. To keep this in mind, I would argue, daily, if we find ourselves reacting to somebody, crossing a line, and beginning to say to ourselves, "I know why they're doing that," or "Can't they do something differently?" Or "I dot dot dot," and they would say, "Stop." And rather than if those passions, those kinds of passions that we've been talking about, that if they bubble to the surface, they're telling you something about yourself more likely than about somebody else. And there might be work to be done there.
In several of these, it's spoken of a demon being the reason for this. Did they have a particular way? I mean, did they rebuke demons, or did they handle it in a case like this? Or, I mean, it's like much of this is, are they blaming themselves, or are they blaming the demon that's causing them to sin? Can you just comment on that?
That's a really good question. And I still wonder. I was talking with Canadian students about this last week, because the demonology is so developed in this literature. You read the biography of Antony. Jeez. For years and years, he's battling demons and beating them up. They're harming him physically. I mean, the extraordinary battles that I have never, ever experienced. So my tendency has been and remains to look at some of the language here and interpret it in terms of more human dynamics than supernatural, natural. I'll be honest with you at that point. However, having said, and I worked in a psychiatric setting, a state psychiatric hospital. So I was seeing patients all the time who were gravely ill with classical psychiatric illnesses, schizophrenia, on and on and on. And I brought this up last week, and it seemed to help the students capture this. And there's a fine line we have to walk, so this is what I'm going to share with you. So I'm convinced that 95% of the patients, if not higher, were struggling psychiatrically, and chemical imbalances, life experiences, any number of things that we could help them with clinically. And then, so I can remember specifically there was one woman, and every time that I would walk by her, I had a collar on. Every time I would walk by her, she'd roll her eyes and stick her tongue out and howl. And I'd go, "Oh, will you just stop?" Because I was like, she had seen The Exorcist, and I was, you know, bringing The Exorcist into her life. Just stop. And the vast majority of the cases is such. But there was one woman who, and this ties in with this question, because my tendency would be to completely interpret this deeply developed demonology in other terms. But what happened once was there was a woman, and she was 80 to 85 years old. She was sexually inappropriate. We couldn't keep clothes on her. She was, her tongue was always distended. She barked all day long. She was frightening. And we all pretty much kept our distance. And I read her file. And in her file, she was a former concert pianist. A concert pianist. And now she was barking like a dog. And that troubled me. So I thought to myself, and I didn't have a lot of experience with the demonic side of reality, I thought to myself, "Well, I'll get a cassette tape. How will she respond to Mozart?" So I was very proud of myself. And I got this cassette tape and sat within a reasonable distance because she frightened me a little bit, and popped this Mozart in, and it connected, the music connected, and someone came back we hadn't seen for a long time. Her expression changed, her tongue moved back into her mouth, if memory serves me correctly, her lips had been distended, she looked suddenly more human, and she started to sway in the music. And I thought, this is wonderful. God's image bearers come back. So I'm proud of myself. Mm. Let's do this with all the patients. So what happened was this. Maybe a month later, I was with a friend, and we're walking down the hallway of the hospital, and I said, I want to show you something. I said, what'd you think? Well, he keeps walking. I didn't realize he kept walking. He kept walking and looking at other patients. I walked into the room. She was sitting in the corner about where you are, Pat. I'm about this far away. She's slumped over. She looks to be asleep. And I thought, let's play some Mozart and I'll have my colleague watch her response and so on. And God's truth, I don't know what to make of it, except it broadened my worldview a little bit regarding this literature. I put this cassette tape in. I'm ready to push down the music, the cassette tape,
the play button.
And she's over there, and I hear someone over here loudly saying, get out of here. And it caught me off guard completely. And I didn't know what to do. I literally did not know what to do. And so my modus operandi when I get scared is get mad and try to hit somebody. And so all I knew to say was, no, no. But then I didn't know what to do. So I put the cassette tape in and walked out of the room. I didn't try to exercise anything or whatever. I didn't have the experience to deal with it. It's a state psychiatric institution. They don't want exorcisms going on. That's not going to work. And you know what? We lost her. She disappeared back into wherever she was. All of that to say then, when I do read this literature, I think this is exaggerated. It seems like every behavior, there's a demon connected with every behavior. There's a demon of lust, and a demon of this, and a demon of that. And my experience hasn't matched up that way. But having had that experience caused me to say, there might be more going on here than meets the eye. But that's all I have to offer at that point. I wish I had more, maybe some of you have more experience, but I do feel that if all that we're doing is we're helping people, is dealing with them on a psychiatric level or whatever, and they're not aware of this broader phenomenon, I think it would be short-sighted, and sometimes this literature helps me. And other times it doesn't. Because it's so often. At times I think, no, that's not what's going on. There's something else. For what it's worth. But that question always comes up when you're dealing with it because it's so prevalent.
Particularly in this literature. You heard the voice say, get out of here.
Oh, without it? Well, unless I was just drinking or something, but I hadn't been. I mean, it was just very distinct. Completely caught me off guard. And it was she was there, but it was over here. Yeah. And I walked out the hallway. I was so taken back by it. I walked down the hallway. Gary Edmonds, Munz, my colleague, and wandered off the hallway. I said, Munz, did you hear that? And it, I was so upset with him. He said, I went out here and wandered down here. I said, you were an idiot. Because then I didn't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. Had I imagined something? But it was so distinct, even spatially. And when I watched what happened to her after that, I wish I had more experience. I probably would have tried to do something else, but it just scared me. It was unnerving. Yeah. Something that I'm sure Christ would have known how to deal with in a manner that I didn't. Yeah.
In our ministry, we do a lot of work with the Jesus Prayer from the Orthodox Church.
And what was that?
In our ministry, we do a lot of work with the Jesus Prayer in the Orthodox Church.
Oh, right.
And it has its roots in the Desert Father spirituality as well. But it's kind of, in some ways, a refinement or building off the Desert Fathers and, in some ways, improving it. But they actually did start making a distinction in the Jesus Prayer spirituality between sins that are growing from within our own hearts that we let grow there, and also temptations or oppressions or attacks by demons. So part of the spirituality is actually discerning which type of sin is it that I'm struggling with and working at it from that angle.
And I think that's right. That sounds just right to me. But if I said to you, I have experience dealing with the more demonic side of reality, I don't. No, but I don't doubt that that kind of discernment is really helpful. And as I was talking to the students, I was surprised. One of them was a police detective in Calgary Police Force who deals with child sex crimes and so on. And he shared some things about these kinds of things that were surprising to me. Anyway, I'd rather talk about it. You know, happier. Is it so, Brad? So what they're saying is, the spirituality that sprung out of the Jesus Spirit, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. That out of that context, then a way of praying the prayer would be in discerning how a given situation and acting accordingly.
Yes, to discern like which type of sin it is that you're struggling with. So as you were praying the prayer, simultaneously the Holy Spirit is bringing sins to your awareness. Like you said, you become aware of yourself in the Jesus Prayer, and you start to realize, you know, that you have these sins, and then being aware of which kind they are, and then praying, because we see the prayer rope as a sword of the Spirit to fight against the sin in our lives. We have to know how to use that rope properly. So it's not just reciting the prayer, but it's also simultaneously dealing with our sins and putting on the Christian virtues and different things like this.
I see. That makes sense to me. When we look at this monastic virtue of discretion, that's what they mean. It's we could even have it here, discretion / discernment. That's what they're talking about. So the Abba, the Amma, who has discernment or discretion, is the one who can discern what's going on in a given situation and respond accordingly. Here we've got one. It's a little bit, this isn't so much demonology as some of the earlier principles we were talking about. Now, again, this is Anthony, who does have a lot of experience, it looks like, with the demonic side of things. But here, he discerns, this is not the heart of the matter. A hunter happened to come through the brush and saw Abba Anthony talking gladly with the brothers and was displeased. It's not appropriate, Anthony. You might have even been smiling, chuckling. That's not the way Abba should act. The old man wanted to show him how we should sometimes be less austere for the sake of the brothers, and said to him, this is that earlier illustration I believe we talked about. Put an arrow in your bow and draw it. He did so, and he said, draw it further, and he drew it. The hunter said to him, if I draw it too far, the bow will snap. So Abba Anthony answered, so it's with God's work. If we go to excess, the brothers quickly become exhausted. It's sometimes best not to be too rigid. So there's a word there. There's a word there for ourselves. The bone needs to get stretched. I think that would be true for all of us. The bone needs to be stretched, and at times we're dealing with folks and we sense, if we discern how God's at work, or we hear their life history, their life experiences, we sense we've got to stretch the bone now. Where discernment and discretion comes in, it is not stretching it so far that it snaps. And that, for these folks, is a gift that comes from the Holy Spirit in this monastic literature. It comes from the Holy Spirit. It comes from being in a learning space. It comes from being in a cell and being quiet. It comes from prayer. It comes from worship. It arises out of that context. And here's another question of discipline, regimen. How far do we go? So Abba Mark asked Abba Arsenius, is it good not to have any comfort to oneself? I saw a brother who had a few cabbages, and he was rooting them out. In other words, he didn't feel like he should even have cabbages. And Abba Arsenius said, it's good, but each person should do what's right for his own discipline. See, they have this
elasticity to that regimen, to that discipline. There's a commonality to it. You need to be in church on Saturday. You need to be in church on Sunday, celebrating the Eucharist together, hours of prayer, so on. There's a continent to it, but within that framework, there's elasticity. If we go too far, or ask someone else to go too far, they won't have the strength to endure it, and they'll give up or walk away discouraged. And the danger, see, here too would be to judge somebody else. To judge somebody else. For instance, there was a young brother who was very poor. He was a shepherd before he entered the monastic community. He had very little food. He had nowhere to sleep at night. He slept on the ground. He didn't have sandals and so on. So he enters the monastic community. This is from this literature. And it's like a step up. He's got a cell, and he's got at least one meal a day. And then he went to visit a well-known monk, and he walked into this well-known monk's cell, who was known for his love and reflection of Christ and all of his good things. He walks in. There were candles in the cell. There was a cot. There was a mat. There was a servant waiting on this monk. The monk was dressed in a robe, and the story goes on, and it says, and the younger brother walked away unedified. And so the monk says to his servant, go get him, bring him back. And basically what the monk says is, you were judging me. Let me tell you my story. And it turns out that the monk that he was judging had served in the emperor's palace. And his step down was much farther than this other monk's step up. But the principle is lusting after bodies is inherently sinful because you depersonalize something. You've simply turned them into a body. So here, the problem is John Cashin, who I mentioned a little bit earlier. John Cashin remembered Abba Moses again. He's always showing up in this literature, said, it's good not to hide the thoughts, but to disclose them to discreet and devout old men. So these are men who are discreet. They're not going to be telling somebody else what you've told them. They're devout, which means they've been deeply formed and shaped into Christ's image. They're leading a disciplined spiritual life. They're engaged in the discipline. And they're old. They have life experience. The problem, however, is, as Abba Moses points out, he says, but not to men who are old merely in years. For many have found final despair instead of comfort by confessing to men whom they thought sought of the age, but who are inexperienced. And so if you share something like this with an inexperienced Abba, as aged as he might be, he won't have the discretion to know how to deal with the situation in a way that brings life rather than condemnation and death. So age in and of itself is not enough if it's not combined together with discretion. Remember that? Discretion combined with devotion. Age, discretion, devotion, that's pretty good. That's somebody you probably can trust. But if something's missing there, things might well go haywire. So this is the same temptation. Another old man said, you should be like a man walking along the street past an inn. Now, oops, what an inn. See that phrase, in? And in the Roman world, in the Greek world, that was very specific. The Apostle Paul, when he traveled, for instance, I would bet money, tried to avoid inns. They were known as places of ill repute. I mentioned some of their characteristics earlier. So if you're walking past an inn, that would be like walking past, I don't know, in the early 60s, an adult theater. And so on. You're walking past an inn and sniffing the smell of the like a man walking past an inn and sniffing the smell of meat frying a roasting. Anyone who likes goes in and eats. People who don't want to pass by only sniff the smell. So you ought to put the smell away from you. Rise, pray, Lord, Son of God. Here's the Jesus prayer. Do this against other temptations. We can't make temptations vanish, but we can struggle against them. And that's my note. It's the only slide I think I've done it. And with, regarding these particular sins, it's very hard to do that on one's own. So, it's lusting after bodies. It's depersonalization. It's being aware of one's context. It's learning to deal with temptation wisely, strategically. Some temptations are, how would I put it, and occasions of sin might well be unavoidable. In his world, if you're stuck in Smyrna and you want to get to Ephesus and it's late at night, you might have to go into an inn because it's dangerous to be on the streets, perhaps. All right, so be aware of what you're facing and act accordingly. It's something along those kinds of lines. And then, this is another patristic principle. Temptation will always be with us. But where they're helpful is struggle. So struggle. Don't just give in. Struggle. Get some help from struggling. And I found particularly with issues that have to do with human sexuality, the human body, habituated responses, the plasticity of the central nervous system, all the things that get engaged in this particular struggle, it's really helpful to have a community engaged with you. But boy, you gotta be careful. There are a lot of people I won't tell things to. I'm just not gonna trust them with that part of my life. I've told you a little bit about me, but I won't tell you everything. Just like you with me. But there's some people who I know so well, they know my story. And I know that if they got word that I was seeing another woman or this behavior, that behavior, I could get at least 5 to 10 phone calls. Trust has been built. And they'd get a phone call from me if some pattern began to raise its head. This is, I think, deeply problematic for young people today, and probably a lot of folks in our congregations, because the shame factor has been reduced so dramatically. You know, when I saw that film earlier, you know, I can still remember, I wanted to put a bag over my head. You know, man, I gotta look somebody in the face, I gotta make $5, I gotta sit in the theater, turn down the lights. I felt ashamed. And I still remember that feeling. And now that's been removed. And within our broader culture is feeding into that shamelessness. Hotels do this. So that you can watch whatever film you want to watch, but they won't put the title of the film on your bill. It's just a number. Well, that doesn't help people. Doesn't help people who are on the road struggling with that. No, it would be more helpful to know someone's going to know about this. But not somebody who's just going to pull a spiritual revolver out there and blow your brains out. But someone who's going to look at a human life and say, yeah, okay, now we got to work with this. And that the best authors were really good at that. They could look into a human life, they had that gift of discernment, and figure out how to help somebody get to a new place. Yeah, this is a favorite of mine. Sometimes when it comes to these particular issues, they're so intimate, so troubling, deeply habitual. They can keep these patterns of behavior from keep off at night. Another brother was going by lust. He rose up in the night and went to tell his temptations to an old man, and the old man consoled him. So he returned comforted to his cell. But again, the spirit of lust tempted him. And the second time he went to the old man. This happened several times. The old man did not reproach him, but spake words to his prophet,
yield not to the devil, guard your soul. Whenever the demon troubles you, come to me, rebuke him, and he'll go away. Nothing troubles the demon of lust more than the disclosure of his pricks. Now, whatever the demonology means, I think there's truth there. You bring something into the light, and part of it, power gets snapped, power gets broken. Nothing pleases him more than the concealment of the temptation. Now look at this. 11 times, the brother went to the old man and blamed himself for his imagining. Now there's something wrong with me. Look what I'm doing. Look what I'm thinking. Did I call myself a monk? And so what this author does is he comes alongside of the brother. He doesn't go into great details. He doesn't want him to be titillated by this older monk's experience. But he does say, believe me, my son, if God allowed the imaginings which go to me to be passed to you, you wouldn't bury me, but would be utterly destroyed. Really, Nabo? Really? You struggle with this too? You've thought these kinds of thoughts too? And he doesn't go into detail, but yeah. Worse. So keep coming back. Keep coming back. If it takes 100 times, 1,000 times, keep coming back. And so by his words and this, his deep humility, that Abba was willing to share something with his younger brother like that, that brother found rest. I'm not alone and isolated in my sin. I'm not the only one. And here is an Abba who struggled with the same thing. Yeah, listen, we made this last one for today. So here you have a different brother struggling again, changing a person into a thing, loving bodies, and so on. So, a brother held in a grip of lust went to a great old man and asked him, of your charity, pray for me, for I'm troubled by lust. So the old man prayed to the Lord. I can hear him, Brett, almost like that dynamic that you were speaking of, right? I have somebody here, what's going on? And so you don't get this cookie cutter response. The response here will be a little bit different. So he prays. The brother comes a second time to the old man and said the same. And again, the old man was careful to beseech the Lord on his behalf and said, Lord, show me why the devil is doing this work in that brother. I pray to you, but he's not found rest yet. And the Lord revealed to him what was happening to that brother. And he saw the brother sitting down, and the spirit rests near him, so to speak, playing with him. And an angel was standing there to help him, and was frowning upon that brother because he didn't throw himself upon God, but took a pleasure in his thoughts and turned his mind towards them. And the old man saw that the chief cause was in the brother himself. So he's toying with something. He's playing with it in a manner that the author spots. So he says to him, you're dallying with your thought. Now, if he had stopped there, that's not helpful. So what does he do? He taught him how to resist thoughts like that. He coaches. And then the brother's soul revived under his teaching and his prayer. And like in the previous saying, he finds rest. Rest. But the rest comes through confession, and it comes through really good coaching. So that the next time he begins to struggle with that habitual pattern of thought, he knows there's 2, 3, 4 things that he can do. And that will help break that pattern of behavior with transformation being the result. Make sense? So I'm telling you, I do feel strongly about this, that young people today are looking for coaches like that. They want purity. And they want chastity, but they don't want to get screamed at. And they don't want to get condemned. And they don't want someone to say that, stop looking at porn, but not coach them in terms of how to do that.
They want a regimen. They want the discipline in the matter of speaking. And then they have hope, the hope that I can change. And it's something so deeply powerful and gripping, and I've got my central nervous system engaged and all these things. I can be free. I can be free, with the result being, in all of these instances that we've talked about, whatever the sin might be, the result is freedom. Freedom to be a human being. A human being, God's image bearer. So, I think that's it for today. So, my idea would be maybe chew on this stuff overnight. And then tomorrow we'll just continue. We'll work on maybe some desert literature. Cashel, we're going to spend some time with him. One of his conferences, we're going to spend some time with Augustine, who's teaching a woman by the name of Proba how to pray. We'll be dealing with Chrysostom a little bit, and a wire bishop from Constantinople. And that pretty much be the day.